From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, what might be next for the administration now that the president's tax and spending bill has passed? Then the slump of the U.S. dollar, sports, Wimbledon begins with upsets, and the story of an old Chinese typewriter found in a New York basement and what its workings may reveal. Professor Thomas Mullaney says,
I'm not a theological religious person. This is like Eve. This is the beginning of it all.
And then variations being made to the classic Philly cheesesteak. So is that what caused a crack in the Liberty Bell? First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, July 5th, 2025.
KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Unlike its neighbors, Minnesota law forbids the usage of aerial exploding fireworks unless you're a municipality or fair association with a permit and a licensed operator. But that doesn't stop trunks and backseats full of illicit products from crossing Minnesota's borders each summer. MinPost reports charges and convictions for violations of the law are rare, but they do happen. Statewide, there's only been between 40 and 90 charges a year and 20 to 60 convictions. Fireworks legalization is regularly proposed at the legislature. It made it as far as the governor's desk in 2012 before Mark Dayton vetoed it, citing opposition from the state fire marshal and public safety officials. Republican Senator Jason Rarick of Pine City authored one such bill in January. He says current laws don't stop Minnesotans from using fireworks, but they do push money out of the state. Rarick tells MinPost he plans to keep proposing legalization and says safety education campaigns could go with it, as well as options for local control. An environmental group is suing to stop construction on a tailings basin expansion near Lake Superior. The Duluth News Tribune reports Water Legacy sued the Department of Natural Resources and Cleveland Cliffs-owned North Shore Mining Co. last month. The group alleges North Shore violated the State Environmental Policy Act by allowing construction before the completion of an environmental impact statement. The Milepost 7 tailings basin near Beaver Bay is 3 miles from Lake Superior and holds back mine waste. Last year, the DNR said a more limited environmental assessment worksheet was enough for the basin's planned 650-acre expansion and dam elevation increase. But in February, the Court of Appeals ruled the DNR erred in its decision and had to reevaluate. The DNR then told North Shore it could continue construction as long as it complied with existing permits. The News Tribune says Water Legacy moved for a temporary restraining order to bar the DNR from awarding the project more approvals and the company from continuing construction. The group says the dam is 45 years old and does not meet modern safety standards. The DNR is updating bait restriction rules to match legislative changes. The new rules define what species are susceptible to viral hemorrhagic septicemia and allows the establishment of VHS-free zones. People who harvest bait to use dead or frozen may be affected. Comments are open until 4:30 p.m. Tuesday. The DNR is also seeking public input on proposed fisheries changes. The agency is considering reducing the statewide walleye limit from 6 to 4. It says this is a proactive step in maintaining quality walleye fishing. You can share your thoughts through August 15th at mndnr.gov/walleye. Find more on all of those on the DNR's website. A new skate park in Brainerd is closer than ever to completion. The Brainerd Dispatch reports the Minnesota legislature awarded $750,000 for the project at Memorial Park in Northeast Brainerd. Skating has been growing in popularity. Jake Reniker is president of the Lakes Area Skate Park Association. He says the park is a way to promote healthy recreation and an economic driver. Right now, the nearest skate park is in Crosby. The legislature awarded $4 million to 8 skate park projects, with Brainerd receiving the largest contribution. According to MinnPost, skate parks got the most general fund money of any projects, with the legislature making cuts this year that may raise some eyebrows. But MinnPost says the money was actually first appropriated in 2023, and this was more of a redirection of the funding. Brainerd is planning a 15,000-square-foot park and must spend the state dollars by 2029. The Dispatch says the Lakes Area Skate Park Association is in its final push for donations to get the last $150,000 it needs. The group will have a booth at the Crow Wing County Fair and is planning a fundraiser this fall. It says naming rights are still up for grabs, too. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. President Trump has called the deadly flooding in Central Texas shocking and says his administration is working with Governor Abbott over federal aid. He made those comments yesterday after he signed his massive policy bill, the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, at a July 4th White House celebration.
Promises made, promises kept, and we've kept them. This is a triumph of democracy on the birthday of democracy, and I have to say that the people are happy.
It's a package that'll cut taxes, add more funding for border security, and also make cuts to major programs like Medicaid. NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben joins us. Danielle, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, good morning, Scott.
And please tell us about yesterday's ceremony.
Well, it was outside the White House at a picnic for military families, including those who participated in Operation Midnight Hammer in Iran. And at the event, B-2s flew overhead. Now, those are the planes that carried those massive bombs targeting those underground nuclear facilities in Iran. Now, Trump came out on a balcony at the White House with First Lady Melania Trump, and he thanked the military members, but he quickly transitioned to celebrating this new policy bill. And then he came down from the balcony to sign it. And he signed it surrounded by Republican Congress members.
A 4th of July event, to be sure, but also a celebration of the administration?
Oh, very much. That was also the case, by the way, in Iowa on Thursday night, too. I was there. It was in Des Moines, and it was meant to be a celebration for America. But really, it looked like any Trump campaign rally, which is to say it was deeply partisan. And there, too, he said he had a couple of weeks of winning that have just passed. After all, Congress passed that new major domestic policy agenda, albeit narrowly. And he had that major strike on Iran and then a ceasefire that is holding at the moment. And then there are also numbers showing that border crossings are way down. And he celebrated that on his trip to Florida this week to a new migrant detainment camp, which the administration is calling Alligator Alcatraz.
The administration points all of this and says that amounts to a lot of winning. Is there more to consider?
Well, absolutely. For example, on Iran, it's still unclear how much of Iran's nuclear capabilities were truly destroyed. And it's unclear if or when they would start rebuilding their program. On that so-called Big Beautiful Bill, that could push nearly 12 million people off Medicaid, according to the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, which has also found that the bill would benefit the wealthy most. Now, Democrats were very worried about that, as were some Republicans, and some Republicans were also upset about how much the bill would add to the debt. According to the CBO, it would add $3.3 trillion. That is a lot. And then there's the fact that it's just not that popular, according to multiple polls. Now, Trump, for his part, simply dismisses that polling. Here he was talking yesterday.
We just have to look forward, fellas, look forward and just say what it is, because it's the most popular bill ever signed in the history of our country.
Danielle, you mentioned the Florida Detention Center. What challenges are there for President Trump and immigration right now?
Well, as you know, immigration has been maybe the central issue for Trump since day one. And so people who vote for him vote for tighter immigration policy. But in practice, this administration's approach to immigration enforcement, it has faced a lot of opposition around the country, for example, in the form of protests. And also, some businesses are just concerned he'll deport their workers. And it's uncertain whether or to what degree that will happen. Trump has, in fact, waffled, for example, on whether he will ease up on raids on places like farms, which rely on a lot of immigrants.
And what about tariffs?
Well, he said he plans to make a lot of tariff moves in this next week. But first, let me remind you of where we are. In early April, Trump announced tariffs on most countries. Then he backed off and set those tariffs at 10% temporarily. He said that on July 9th, the rates would jump back up. But then before then, he would negotiate rates country by country. Well, July 9th is coming, and he's negotiated rates with two countries, the UK and Vietnam. So now he says he'll send out letters simply notifying countries of their tariff rates. So soon, we're going to find out how much American businesses and likely consumers will be paying for imports.
And NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thanks so much, Danielle.
Thank you, Scott.
A massive search and rescue operation is underway in Texas following deadly floods. Among the missing, a group of girls attending a Christian summer camp. We will follow all the developments here on Weekend Edition and across NPR throughout the day. Stay tuned to your local NPR station. Keep your browser at npr.org for all the latest news. Since assessments continue to change and the damage done to Iran's nuclear facilities after U.S. and Israeli bombings, the latest indicate that Iran's nuclear program could be set back a year or two. Now, Iranian officials maintain they have the right to continue what they insist is a civilian nuclear program, but any enrichment is currently a red line for the Trump administration, and talks are scheduled next week between Iran and the U.S. in Oslo. Richard Nephew is senior research scholar at Columbia University. He served as deputy special envoy for Iran during the Biden administration and on the National Security Council and in the State Department during the Obama administration. Mr. Nephew, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
In a piece for Foreign Affairs, you wrote that if Iran managed to hide and bury its stockpile of highly enriched uranium, that would give them what you called breakout options. What are those?
So basically, when we talk about breakout, we're talking about Iran's ability to produce enough material for its first nuclear weapon, and then to be able to take that material and to put it into bomb components. And if Iran has been able to hide and then find again all of the highly enriched uranium that they had produced previously, they would have a pretty quick ability to move towards nuclear weapons.
And I have to ask, this week Iran's president signed a new law that suspends cooperation with UN nuclear inspectors. That was a key aspect of Iran becoming a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. How do you read this move?
Well, I think it, two levels. First, you know, I think the Iranians are concerned that the international inspectors have given information, you know, even just publicly, that may have enabled Israeli and U.S. military strikes. But second, you know, if the Iranians do have an intent to try and race towards a bomb, making sure that international inspectors aren't there looking is one of the first steps that you would take.
You were on the team that negotiated the nuclear deal a decade ago. Over the past few weeks, we've seen much of Iran's defense system damaged. Could this create an incentive for a deal or just the opposite?
I mean, it could create an incentive for a deal, but I think the much more likely outcome, especially considering how much Iran's nuclear program may have been hidden, is that the Iranians instead will say, okay, you know, we don't particularly like the idea of being attacked again. You know, what's the best way that we can stave that off? And that's if we demonstrate that we've got nuclear weapons capability, something that they may be able to do relatively quickly and cheaply, especially when considered with how much effort would be required to rebuild their missile program, their air defense systems, you know, those sorts of things.
Well, and that raises maybe an overall question. Has this recent war and the exchange of missiles just persuaded Iran's leadership that what they need to stay in power is a nuclear weapon?
Yeah, that's my big worry. When you decide to go into military force to address a nuclear problem, frankly, you better not miss. And you need to make sure that you're able to deal with all the aspects of that nuclear program, because otherwise, what you've signaled is, you're defenseless. We have the ability to overfly you at will. We have the ability to attack your facilities and your cities at will. And I think any state would look at that situation and say, well, we need something that's going to scare everybody not to do that. Mm-hmm. That's especially the case if you're the Iranians, and if you've already kind of come into the international system with a sense that everyone's out to get you. I really think the Iranian state's view at this point has got to be about, trying to ensure regime survival, and that points in the direction of nuclear weapons.
At the same time, let me ask you about the effect of sanctions. President Trump, of course, left that nuclear agreement in his first term and imposed harsh sanctions. Do they provide an incentive for Iran to pursue negotiations and not have a nuclear development program?
They certainly could, or at least sanctions relief, right? So at this point, we've probably imposed sanctions on everything that we can. There's still Iran's ability to export a small amount of oil to China. That's at this point kind of keeping the Iranian economy afloat. But right now, the best incentive that we've got to the Iranians not to pursue nuclear weapons is to say, okay, we're prepared to relieve a whole bunch of sanctions against you, allow you to do a lot more business internationally, allow money to flow in, allow reconstruction, and in exchange, have conditions on the nuclear program, possibly the missile program and other things. Fundamentally, that was what the nuclear deal back in 2015 did. Now we have a little bit of an advantage by the nuclear program having been badly damaged. At the same time, the Iranians now have a deep distrust of the United States. We've already withdrawn from one deal. Now we've joined in a military attack. There's no clear indication we can keep the Israelis from attacking again if they want to. So, all those things apt to being a pretty tough sell on the diplomatic side.
Well, and that raises this final question. Given your experience negotiating with Iranian officials, what kind of deal do you think might be possible, or are the talks just for show?
I don't think they're for show, and I think the Iranians would do a deal. But I do think that getting them to accept no uranium enrichment in the country forever and ever is probably beyond what we're able to achieve. I think the Iranians will insist on having at least some notional capability. Whether or not they actually execute that is a whole separate question.
A notional capability, meaning the ability to develop nuclear power for civilian uses.
Exactly. And that might be limited. That might be, circumscribed. It might be time limited. You can start this program in 15 years when you have your first reactors being built that can, actually use enriched uranium. I can imagine that sort of deal. But otherwise, it's going to be pretty difficult, I think, to get the Iranians to accept something now.
Richard Nephew at Columbia, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to NPR News. And you're listening to NPR News.
18 minutes after 8 o'clock. Thank you for listening to People Powered KAXE and Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human explores the question, what is sovereignty? We'll hear from the Generalissimo of the Island Republic, Marsh Muirhead, also attorney Frank Bebo, and many more. Words and music for spirit and courage. This also airs tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Kutaska Community Action hosts a Big View discussion Tuesday, July 8th at Community Presbyterian Church in Grand Rapids. The topic is defining allyship. Lunch begins at 11:30. Conversation to follow. Registration required. Email alicem@kutaska.org. There's more ahead from Weekend Edition on KAXE.
It's the people of northern Minnesota that power KAXE.
I'm a member because I feel a sense of belonging being part of KAXE, because I know that they are representing me and the communities and people in our area and the work that we're doing in such a truthful and honest way. I love being able to share it nationally and tell people I've met across the nation, like, you can understand more about what it's like to live in northern Minnesota by listening online. There's so much that is of value to people anywhere. It's just an honor to contribute and be part of it.
Help us out. Tell us why you are a member. Text us at 218-326-1234 and keep KAXE powered. We're independent, we're local, we're not run by corporations, the government, or a national network. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Dignity Memorial. For many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com. From Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Many families in Texas desperately hope for news about their loved ones today. Devastating floods swept through their homes and a summer camp after record rainfall caused the Guadalupe River to break its banks. We're joined now by Sarah Spivey, a meteorologist at KSAT News in San Antonio. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. It's a tragic day for us here.
Well, indeed. And I have to ask you, what, because of course thunderstorms in the summer happen in Texas, what made this storm so different?
Well, we have a low pressure system directly overhead, Scott. And unfortunately, in the summer months, you know, we usually deal with stagnant weather patterns, very dry. But that stagnant weather pattern is actually one of the reasons why we're dealing with flooding right now, because usually in the fall and winter, we have cold fronts to help kick these low pressure systems out of our way. So it's a one and done rain event. But with this low pressure system overhead right now and nothing to kick it out of the way, we're essentially looking at a rain bomb directly overhead.
What can you tell us about the Texas Hill Country, this area affected by the flooding? What made it maybe particularly so vulnerable?
Yes, well, first of all, we have the terrain here, which it's called the Hill Country for a reason. Winding hills and a river, Guadalupe River, that runs through these hills onto limestone. So there's not much area for the water to soak into. And late on July 4th, the early morning hours of July 4th, we saw rainfall over, in a short period of time, 10 inches of rain fall west of Kerrville. And unfortunately, along that riverbank, there were lots of summer camps out there. Mm-hmm. And with rain happening in the middle of the night, the floodwaters quickly rose while these kids were sleeping. In some cases, we saw the Guadalupe River rise 20 feet in an hour, Scott.
And I gather there's more rain in the forecast today. This must complicate rescue efforts.
Yes. Thankfully, right now, the rain has let up in the Kerr County area, and the Guadalupe River has actually now stopped flooding. And so rescue efforts are able to continue now. However, with that rain bomb I mentioned earlier sitting still directly overhead, there is yet again another flood watch until 7 p.m. tonight, as we're watching for the potential for additional flooding in these areas.
Sarah, if I may call you Sarah, what are your thoughts as you look at this? Have you seen anything that approaches it before?
Well, it's an unfortunate thing within our community that our major droughts tend to end in major floods. You know, we're in a multi-year drought here in this area. And if you've been in this area long enough, you know, even in 1987, there was a flood very similar to the one that is happening right now across the Guadalupe. Our droughts tend to end with these rain bombs in the summer months. And it's just something that we have to prepare for over and over again in the future. Whenever there's a flood watch, we have to take that very seriously. Mm-hmm. And my thoughts and prayers are just with all of those parents that are waiting to hear from their children.
Sarah Spivey at KSAT News, meteorologist in San Antonio. Thank you so much for joining us, Sarah.
Thanks for having me on.
And now it's time for sports. A upsets at Wimbledon, Gold Cup final, and the hot dog king sits back at the table. Michelle Steele of ESPN joins us. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet, Scott.
Bad week to be an American tennis player at Wimbledon, wasn't it? Coco Gauff, yeah. Jessica Pegula, Francis Tiafoe, Tommy Paul, all out, first two rounds of play. What's going on?
Yeah, in Coco Gauff's case especially, Scott, we just saw her win the French Open. But she told reporters later, you know, she felt mentally overwhelmed. She didn't have time to adjust. After having just made a really deep run, of course, on clay courts to the grass at Wimbledon. Now, making that transition is famously not easy, but it's not easy for anyone. So if there's a rash of American stars who ended their run early, you got to give some credit to the opponents as well.
And four out of the top five seeded women were eliminated in the first two rounds, weren't they? And same goes for five of the top 10 men. What do you think we're seeing?
Well, we're seeing an upset fest is what we're seeing. It's not just the
Americans. Oh, I know that, but why?
Well, I just mentioned the transition is a little tricky, right? Going from clay to grass. But I think, personally, I think this just speaks to the depth on the men's and the women's sides. The players outside the top 20 these days, they're in better shape. They're better coached. Yeah. And remember, those lower-ranked seeds are coming in with nothing to lose. So there's some freedom in that. It makes for some exciting viewing.
Gold Cup. Soccer final is tomorrow in Houston, U.S. versus Mexico. Diego Luna's been the best player for the U.S. so far this tournament. Quite a backstory, doesn't he?
Yeah, you know, he was born and raised in California to parents of Mexican descent. So he was eligible to play for the U.S. or Mexico. But after he was committed to the U.S. team last year, he got the call up to the U.S. team. He talked about wanting to give back to the country that he was born in. And guess what? Now we've got a breakout performance from him in the current Gold Cup. They face Mexico tomorrow, Sunday, in Houston. It's going to be essentially an away game for the U.S. team because those Mexican fans always come out. And the U.S. is going to be going to need to be very disciplined because they're going to be focused on Diego Luna and limiting his chances. It's going to be a fun game, physical game, and a lot of emotion on both sides.
U.S. is slightly favored, I have read.
Yeah, and you know what? And that comes to some consternation, I'd say, to the Mexican fans and certainly the Mexican team, because normally, historically, this Mexican squad has dominated the U.S., but not as of late.
And Michelle, some people might not consider this a sport, but we made room for it this week. The Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. Miki Sudo won her 11th title in the women's division. She ate 33 hot dogs. Oh, excuse me. Joey Chestnut reclaimed the mustard belt. He ate 70 and a half hot dogs in 10 minutes. I gather this is not his best performance, but it was good enough to win.
An off year.
An off year for him. So, and he could not participate last year, right? Was this a triumphant return?
Yeah, I think it was for him. You know, he still ate 70 and a half hot dogs in 10 minutes. That was...
Did they get charged? That just occurred to me.
Maybe they do.
How do you tip? But go ahead.
I'm pretty sure they're comped on those. Nathan's is pretty happy to get that kind of publicity. But he ate, Scott, 20 more hot dogs than the next guy. And, you know, for these hot dog contest enthusiasts out there, they were waiting for Joey Chestnut to come back because he missed the tournament last year. He had signed a sponsorship deal with a plant-based hot dog company, and that's a big no-no, you know, for the Nathan's Hot Dog Contest organizers. But let's give some credit here also to Miki Sudo on the women's side.
Right.
It's not just about Joey Chestnut. She ate 33 hot dogs. I interviewed her recently. Guess what? Her husband is also a competitive eater, and they practice all week eating things like cabbage to help expand their stomachs. And Scott, it shivers my timbers to think about their household the week before, you know, the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. But talk about a match made in hot dog heaven.
Oh, my gosh. Michelle Steele of ESPN, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Scholars are buzzing about a typewriter they believed was lost to history. It holds important clues about the origins of Chinese computing, and it's revived questions about the politics of language. Why is this typewriter so important? We asked NPR's Emily Feng to find out.
Stanford professor Thomas Mullaney was at a conference last year when he got a message. Someone in upstate New York had found a strange machine in their basement and posted a picture of it online.
It was a sleepless night. I was randomly searching who the owner might be.
Mullaney spent 20 years studying Chinese computers. Admittedly, that sounds niche, but China's entry into modern computing has changed the technology we use today. To do that, some of the brightest Chinese minds of the 20th century had to figure out how to type the complex pictographs that make up written Chinese. One man, this man, succeeded more than any other before him. His name was Lin Yutang. Here is a recording of him speaking in 1967. He made just one prototype of his Chinese typewriter.
I had really, truly thought it was gone.
But last year, Mullaney confirmed that machine found in that New York basement was the only ever prototype of Lin's typewriter, called the Mingkuai. Mullaney studied the ideas behind the machine for 2 decades without ever seeing it in person.
It's like a family member just showing up at your doorstep and you just had assumed you would never see them.
The story of why such a typewriter even exists runs parallel to the political upheaval and conflict over Chinese identity and politics in the 20th century. Lin was born in 1895 in southern China during the tail end of a failing Qing dynasty. Student activists and radical thinkers were desperate to reform and to strengthen China. Some proposed dismantling traditional Chinese culture in favor of Western science and technology and eliminating Chinese characters altogether in favor of a Roman alphabet. But Jia Fangcai, the director of the Lin Yutang Foundation in Taiwan, says Lin wanted to chart a middle course, a way that married both East and West and preserved the Chinese language and the digital age. This was a monumental challenge. Chinese has no alphabet. Instead, it uses tens of thousands of pictographs, think hieroglyphics of sorts. And when Lin started his work in the early 20th century, there were also hundreds of dialects and languages spoken, meaning there was no singular phonetic spelling of the sound of each word either.
He spent a lot of money on that. A lot.
That's Jill Lai Miller, Lin's granddaughter. She says Lin nearly bankrupted himself trying to build his typewriter. And then it was lost to history. Until now. Since being discovered, it's been acquired by Stanford University, and Mullaney, on its campus, carefully opens the machine's wooden casing.
It's a beautifully made piece of machinery. It's like, so intricate.
Mullaney's trying to understand how the machine works, and the far-off dream of perhaps one day building more machines like it.
Can I touch it?
Yeah, of course you can. Just don't push down on it, but you can.
But the typewriter's real genius comes from the way Lin decided to break down Chinese pictographs by their shapes, not sounds. You search for a certain combination of shapes using its keyboard, then a little pop-up menu offers the typist up to 8 possible characters that might match. In this way, the typewriter boasts that it can retrieve up to 90,000 characters.
I'm not a theological or religious person. This is like Eve. This is the beginning of it all.
Because these concepts underlie how we type Chinese, Japanese, and Korean today. And it's a direct rebuttal to voices in and outside of China that once said
that the price of entry to modernity is our culture, our language.
I read the manual that comes with the typewriter.
Types the Chinese, Japanese, English, and Russian alphabets.
Meaning encoded in the machine was an ambitious globalism. Here's Yangyang Chang, a writer who first wrote about the typewriter's discovery.
One thing that was very interesting and very important in Lin Yutang's thinking about Chineseness and Chinese culture is that it must not be insular. It must have this porous border. It must be capacious and be able to communicate and talk with other cultures.
This ability to translate seamlessly between languages and identities draws from Lin's own bilingual and nomadic life.
Especially at a time when the cultural and political contours of the world were being redrawn.
Redrawn in the wake of a fading Chinese empire. Lin was educated in the U.S., and later, after the Communist Party took control of mainland China, he took up residence in Taiwan, plus the then-British colony of Hong Kong. To him, the hope for an open, multicultural China, for which he designed the typewriter, no longer existed.
A, B, C.
Mullaney, the Stanford professor, is now using a dental mirror to peer inside the machine. He thinks the typewriter perhaps contains one last secret.
You'll notice that the ink spool is still there.
Malini thinks the spool could contain the traces from the last time someone typed on the machine, meaning perhaps Ling's words are in this machine too. Emily Fang, NPR News, Stanford, California.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The U.S. dollar has long been a symbol of America's financial dominance, but this year, the dollar has fallen over 10% in value. Its worst start of the year since 1973. And that raises the question, is the U.S. losing its financial standing in the world? NPR Senior Business Editor Raphael Nam joins us. Raphael, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Why is the dollar down so much?
Well, Scott, it boils down to this. American stocks and bonds are no longer that popular anymore. And that's a big change. For years, foreign investors have been scooping up U.S. stocks and bonds, and those transactions have to happen in dollars because, obviously, you need dollars to, say, buy 100 shares of Microsoft, for example. So the bottom line is when foreigners buy American things, the dollar gains. But this year, not so much. In fact, foreign investors have been selling bonds and stocks. It's become prevalent enough that it's now known as a sell America trade.
Why sell America?
Because it's been an incredibly chaotic year so far. Whether you agree with President Trump's policies or not, it's just been a fire hose of events. There's been tariffs on just about every country in the world. Trump picked a fight with the Federal Reserve over interest rates. There's the conflict with Iran. All those things create a lot of uncertainty. And the truth is that foreign investors do have other choices. We're seeing that play out right now. The S&P 500 is up more than 6% this year. Not bad, honestly, considering the year we've had. But both the German and the Hong Kong stock indexes have far outperformed the U.S. stock markets.
Raphael, does this seem to you to be a short-term blip or a longer trend?
That's the trillion-dollar question, Scott. The truth is, there are few markets as big and as open as the U.S. It's why the U.S. has been so dominant. But the U.S. has longstanding issues as well. There have been deep political divisions for years now. And then there's the debt. The U.S. continues to load up on debt. That was manageable when interest rates were low. But they're not anymore, and paying off that debt is getting very expensive. And now there's this GOP mega bill that will add trillions of dollars of additional debt. This is Harvard professor Kenneth Rogoff, who's been studying global economies for decades and recently wrote a book about the dollar.
The dollar's reserve currency status has been fraying at the edges for at least a decade, and the process is accelerating under Trump.
And you know, Scott, that's something I've heard from others too. This selling America trade is not just about Trump. It's about these longstanding issues that the U.S. has yet to resolve.
I have to ask Raphael if there's not a more positive way of looking at this. I mean, there are some benefits to a weaker dollar, aren't there?
Well, for sure. Many domestic manufacturers have long been struggling because a stronger dollar makes them less competitive against imports. And it's great for tourism, for example. A weaker dollar is maybe not so good if you were planning to go to Paris, for example, but it's good news if you are a shop owner in Times Square. At the end of the day, exchange rates do go up and down. But we still have this habit of using currencies as a sign of national standing, of virility, as one analyst put it to me. But the dollar's history makes the U.S. a little different. I mean, the dollar has been a source of pride for decades. And this question, will the dollar ever lose its dominance? It used to be more of an academic debate, Scott, but today it's a genuine question being asked by many investors around the world.
NPR's Raphael Nam, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 8:39. We receive support from the U of M Extension Forestry, hosting the Minnesota Woodland Steward Program in Itasca County to help develop a deeper understanding of forest stewardship and manage fire risk. Registration open until August 10th with a discount for Itasca County landowners. More info at My Minnesota Woods on Facebook. The Bemidji Public Library has their summer book sale July 15th through the 17th from 10 to 6 each day at the Evangelical Free Church on Car Lake Road. Thursday features a bag sale, cash or check only. And the nonprofit iLink Minnesota helps those with low vision and blindness by providing technology-based solutions. Find more information and donate by searching for iLink Minnesota. That is I spelled E-Y-E. We continue with Weekend Edition.
So much for listening to KAXE KBXE. My name is Heather Johnson, and I'm the membership coordinator here. If you're enjoying our music, news, phonology updates, and conversations, consider supporting the station by becoming a KAXE KBXE member today. Do you have questions about membership? We offer many options for making your contribution. I would love to chat with you. Give me a call at 218-326-1234. Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Recent college graduates across the country may be asking themselves big questions about their futures. One recent graduate turned to the microphone to seek answers, and she was a finalist in NPR's College Podcast Challenge this year. NPR's Lauren McGuckey has more about this young podcaster.
I graduated.
Sheridan Hollis, Bachelor of Science, Integrated Communication.
I did pretty good, all considering.
Sheridan Hollis at Minnesota State University Mankato tackled a big existential question.
Now that I've graduated, I've started looking into work, which is terrifying. And I've had to figure out why I did all this to begin with.
Hollis is passionate about radio, but she wanted to know, where did that come from? To find out, she looked back at her childhood and went to a reliable source of information.
Hello.
Her mom.
Tell me a bit about how you saw me growing up.
You really wanted to be a veterinarian.
Hollis's mom remembers when her daughter was in the fourth grade and sang at a school performance. She said that was a turning point.
Your singing voice was such a shock to me. How did I not know you could sing the way that you did? People came up to us after and said, she has a beautiful voice. And I'm not shocked that you got into something with your voice.
Singing wasn't the only thing I was doing in fourth grade. I was trying to run radio shows.
That was part one. Next one will be number 13 and SpongeBob's greatest hit, Gary's Songs.
As she got older, her interest in radio grew.
Let me introduce you to the one, the only, Mav FM. 20 students, including myself, joined together to help run the student radio. There, I ended up learning a lot more about audio.
Once she'd gotten the basics down, Hollis launched her own show.
My name is Sheridan, and I'm your host for Meeting with the Majors. I'm going to ask you 10 questions about your major.
Oh my goodness.
No more, no less. That's all you get.
Along the way, Hollis figured out this is what she wants to do with her life.
I think I got drawn towards this because I just want to hear people. I want to hear their stories. I want to hear what makes them who they are.
My name is Neil.
Or maybe that's just a cop-out answer and I don't even know why I got into it.
In some words of advice that may apply to a lot of us, Fallis says the why of her chosen career path may not be all that important.
Maybe I don't need to know why I got into anything. Maybe I can just enjoy it.
Lauren Migaki, NPR News.
That's all I have for you. Thank you, and keep listening.
And I hope you listen to my next track. Thanks very much. Bye.
The Philly cheesesteak started as a pile of chopped steak, salt, pepper, and onions on a roll, until Cocky Joe, a guy working at Pat's King of Steaks, added cheese, and that began a distinct sandwich culture in Philadelphia that continues to evolve. Reporter Buffy Gorilla visits where it started and where it's going.
It's a hot, humid game day afternoon at Cheesesteak Corner in Philadelphia. At neighborhood rivals Pat's King of Steaks and Gino Steaks, Phillies and Mets fans unite over hot sandwiches.
My name is Dominic De Laurentiis, the only one, just like Dino De Laurentiis, the movie producer.
De Laurentiis is from New Jersey. He's sitting at one of Gino's signature orange tables with his wife. All evidence of the thinly sliced meat covered in drippy whiz on a soft roll has disappeared.
I've been waiting to come here for 30 years and make exact words where I'm here to try the infamous cheesesteak.
And what did they give you?
The lady says, so you want the one with the whiz cheese? I said, I guess so. Damn, finally here. It tasted good.
Mike Medeo is a food writer and a sandwich lover.
20 years, and I've always wanted to do something about Philly sandwiches just because they're so amazing, and I wanted to share my love for them with the world.
His book, A History of Philadelphia Sandwiches, Steaks, Hoagies, Iconic Eateries, and More, is a bread-wrapped history of the old standards and some new riffs on the classics.
There's a place making an Ethiopian cheesesteak with Berber spices. There's a Jamaican jerk cheesesteak. There's an oxtail cheesesteak. There's a place making a Filipino-style cheesesteak.
Interest piqued by this Filipino version, Medeo and I walk 10 minutes to Taba Choy. There's a before-service calm. The only buzz in the air is the overworked air conditioner.
Hey, nice to meet you. Welcome in.
Thanks.
But I felt like a cheesesteak was such an accessible, approachable way to not diminish Filipino cuisine, but also to not diminish this, like, legendary Philadelphia food as well.
Chef Chance Enyes owns Taba Choy. His food truck sold classic Filipino cuisine at local breweries, but customers craved game day food. So he gave them the Bistek Chistek, a cheesesteak with Filipino flair.
We kind of are referencing as a Bistek Tagalog, which is like a thinly sliced steak that has a bunch of calamansi, which is a Filipino lime with a little bit of soy sauce and black pepper and
but cheesesteaks need cheese.
We made a chili vin whiz, which was like a Thai chili.
Is your mouth watering?
And then we would add a pickle in the Philippines we call achara. It's a green papaya, carrot, a little bit of onion.
Because
garlic,
we're not done yet.
And hit it with some scallions and fried shallots, always on a seeded roll. It's got a lot going on. It's definitely a juicy sandwich.
Back at Cheesesteak Corner, De Laurentiis isn't interested in any changes to the iconic sandwich.
No. For a full, boring Italian, it's got to be plain and simple like this. Everybody has their own view. That's my point of view.
But clearly, Philadelphia has a cheesesteak for every taste bud. For NPR News in Philadelphia, I'm Buffy Gorilla.
Papilio is an enthusiastic and adventurous caterpillar.
Papilio can't wait to join the world. Today is the day, she decides. She bursts out of her egg.
And she becomes a chrysalis.
Growing up sure is weird sometimes, thinks Papilio. But as every caterpillar knows, you can't become a butterfly without first becoming caterpillar soup. C'est la vie.
Her main goal in life is to metamorphize into a butterfly and learn to fly.
Wow, that flower looks yummy. I haven't eaten in ages. I suppose I have to fly to get up there. But where do I start? Maybe like this? Nope, definitely not like this.
Papilio is a children's story told in three parts about three stages of life. And it's written and illustrated by three friends.
Most of the time.
That's right.
Yeah, we've known each other for a decade now, maybe plus.
For our series, picture this: Ben Clanton, Corey R. Tabor and Andy Chow Musser talk about their cross-pollination. Collaboration.
Andy and I were already making some books together, and we had so much fun doing that that we went, what would happen if we added another friend into the mix?
When they asked me, I was surprised, but my answer was yes right away. It sounded like such a fun project, and I think in this line of work, just if something sounds fun, that's a good enough reason to try it, and that's where it started.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Corey. We talked to Corey one day, and he was like, I woke up in the middle of the night, and I had this idea of the stages of a butterfly, and we each write and illustrate a different stage.
Yeah, we wanted to do the project because it would just be a fun thing to do between the three of us, but we thought that there needed to be some kind of a reason for three authors and illustrators to work together on a project, and the butterfly just seemed like a perfect way to kind of justify that and for each of us to show off our own voice and illustration style.
So her name's Papilio. She's a black swallowtail butterfly, or Papilio polyzenus. Am I getting that right? I hope so. The choice of species to begin with, that was Andy.
Ben and Corey were super generous and let me have a lot of say in what butterfly that we went with because I was illustrating the final chapter. And I looked at a bunch of different butterflies and I thought, I want a fantastical looking butterfly, but I also want one that is maybe a little bit unexpected. And so I thought, what if we chose a butterfly that had almost no color at all?
So we started out with the caterpillar phase. I took on that section. This is Ben. There's four stages for a butterfly's life. We get a little bit of egg time in the caterpillar section. And it's really just about growing up. In the caterpillar phase, I was inspired by my youngest son and just this unstoppable wonder and curiosity he had. And I put a lot of that into Papilio's character as she's just entering this world.
Corey very courageously said that he would do the chrysalis section, which was a huge relief to me because that one seemed like the toughest nut to crack.
Yeah, I'd read somewhere when we were researching butterflies that when they go from caterpillar to chrysalis, they kind of dissolve into goo and then they just kind of hang out for a week or so and rebuild their body. And the challenge with that was the character can't really do anything. She's just stuck inside of her chrysalis the whole time. So I think it was Ben or Andy who had the idea that the chrysalis itself would be going on this wild adventure while Papilio is completely oblivious inside. A bird has landed on her branch and is looking at her chrysalis, and then the bird grabs the chrysalis with her beak and flies off with it. And so then the bird fights with another bird over the chrysalis, and then the chrysalis goes flying through the air. So I kind of took that idea and just ran with it.
Something that I see within it is there's a lot of uncertainty, but having to just kind of accept that. Like, she is changing, but she can't impact the world around her. She just has to kind of trust in the process.
Yeah, I think that's probably something that's familiar to children too, that idea that things are happening around you and you're growing, and some of the time you just have to just go with it and see what happens. Originally, our idea was just change and transformation, the whole metamorphosis. And as we worked on it, it became more a story about growing up. And I think that kind of just happened naturally. The story changed as we worked on it.
In the butterfly section, this is Andy speaking. There's a part where Papilio is very disappointed. Papilio has to learn to fly. And flying is a lot harder than Papilio expected. And we needed an expression of that disappointment. And I couldn't think of one, and Corey had a great idea. He's like, what if Papilio curses by saying, sluggity slime?
Was that my idea?
Yeah.
I don't know if I can take credit for that. We had a meeting where we were trying to come up with the songs, and we had lots of ideas, but I think the ones that we went with were Andy's.
Yeah, I think I started those off. I really like to make up silly songs. When we had the idea to write songs for Papilio, I was very excited and had a lot of ideas. We don't have a melody or anything for Papilio songs, do we yet?
We never have.
I have a voice that sounds in my head, but do you guys each have voice that sounds in your head?
I think this one's on Ben. Go for it. Do you need the book? We have it here.
Okay. When turning into a chrysalis, she goes, got a full belly, time to turn to jelly. I imagine it's just like, you know, like a little kid at that point, kind of just making up as she goes, you know, time to unfurl, then give these wings a whirl.
Excellent. Bravo.
That's how it sounds in my head, at least. Yeah, I think we all agreed at the beginning that we like hapless heroes. That helps set the tone a bit. And then Corey also had finished this piece of the chrysalis flying through the air. And that's where the palette, I think, kind of got established, where we're like, oh yeah, that's nice.
I would say color-wise, soft pastel tones, a bit impressionistic. Some areas are painterly. Some areas feature a lot of collage. Some areas use line work.
My section tends towards cartoony at moments. Cartooning is kind of my go-to.
Corey's section. Corey, what media do you use? I see it looks to me like color pencil or maybe crayon.
Yeah, it's color pencil and watercolor. I think I wanted it to have kind of like a loose, wild feel to it to kind of match the adventure that the chrysalis goes on while Papilio's oblivious inside.
It has a very spring feel to me. Like it feels like spring colors.
Oh yeah, I did that on purpose. Definitely. One idea is that we would kind of retain our own illustration style, and that the idea of that Papilio is changing, and so each stage of life she sees the world a little bit differently, so it makes sense that the illustrations would change a little bit with her.
We each use some of our own supplies. In the case of the caterpillar stage, given that it was like this kind of toddler new to the world, that I took a similar let's explore play approach with art. I ended up using all sorts of things, same thing I could get my hands on. Watercolors, ink, I did leaf pressings, stamps, markers, colored pencil, and collaged it all together.
For the butterfly section, I used gouache, which is a type of watercolor, and colored pencil. I was a bit stumped about how to write the ending. And then I learned a really helpful fact that butterflies, when they're born, they don't know how to fly. And it takes them some practice to learn how to use their wings. And that really informed how I wrote my section. I think Papilio really learns that it's okay to fail and that practice is really important and that being tenacious and trying something over and over again pays off.
One great takeaway from the book is Papilio's determination. Andy has a great section in his part where Papilio is like, I'm a butterfly and I am gonna fly. And just that, like, I don't know, that determination is a great thing that you can take from this.
I think one of the things that Papilio discovers as she goes through this journey is that it's okay to have help, to find a friend. That's one of my favorite parts that ended up getting into the book, is we have this mouse that reoccurs throughout all three parts. And that friendship, I think, reflects our own sort of friendship, too, in the making of the book.
I hope that readers enjoy the story and they have a fun time. And I hope it encourages them to collaborate with the people around them. And instead of seeing other people or friends as competition, seeing them as potential partners for making something new.
Andy Chaumusser, Ben Clanton, and Corey R. Tabor talking about their children's book, Papilio. Our series Picture This is produced by Samantha Balaban. For more conversations like this one, you can head to npr.org/picturethis. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation at wtgrantfoundation.org.
It is just before 9 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 in the Brainerd area and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. Thanks so much for your support. Coming up in a few moments, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, and 10 o'clock, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Support comes from the First State Bank of Big Fork with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. The North Country Trail Association will designate Cohasset and Grand Rapids as official trail towns this Thursday, July 10th, 1:30 at the Itasca County Fairgrounds. Hikes of varying lengths will follow the presentation, Bring Your Own Water and a Snack. And Pequot Lakes Community Theater presents Roald Dahl's Willy Wonka, July 11th through the 20th at Pequot Lakes High School Theater. Friday shows at 7 o'clock and Saturday and Sunday shows are at 2 p.m. Coming up at 4 o'clock today on the river with your volunteer host, Dave Murphy, and then our ever-popular green cheese trivia show, Brandon Chase, your volunteer host tonight, 9 o'clock after dark with Diane Ott. She'll feature Southern Rock Deep Cuts. Right now, it is time for Stay Human.